At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Well, this week, I am thrilled to have back one of my dearest friends, Jed Ayers, who is an author of books such as Fierce Bitches and Peckerwood. And I always love bringing up those titles because I sound like a badass for like 5 seconds. And Jed, of course, was in my pandemic movie club, as longtime listeners know. He's one of my game night crew friends. We've delved into so many topics on the podcast in the past: 90s crime movie remakes, extreme sports movies. We've done Elmore Leonard westerns and more. Terriers, the TV show. We did a whole investigative piece on that where we like rewatched the series twice and we did a lot of research. That was a blast. I always have a good time with Jed. We also had a Mr. In Between episode that I love that he was a part of. If you haven't listened to that one or seen the show, you know, just like Terriers, Mr. In Between, you know, go to Hulu and watch these things for sure. But Jed, thank you so much for coming back. How are you doing?
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always fun to be on your show and listen to your show. I just listened to the Christoph Faust Rodeo episode this week, and that was fun. I'm a big fan of both Krista and you, and it's nice to, it's weird, like my worlds are kind of, you know, intersecting, and I've known Krista for a long time, but it's cool that now you guys are talking, and it's fun to hear you guys, smart people with lots of insights, talk to each other. It's good stuff. So thanks for having me back. I'm happy to be here.
Of course. Yeah. She had been a longtime Twitter mutual. She has such great taste in movies. I mean, you know that, of course. She's like a noir encyclopedia, but I wasn't sure because she was so busy for a while and she was taking Twitter breaks and I didn't want to bother her. And then I finally asked, she's like, are you kidding? Yes. So that was wonderful. So we'll definitely have to have Krista back. That episode just dropped. So if you're listening, check out the Rodeo Movies episode with Krista Faust. It was a lot of fun. I think I learned a lot about American rodeo that I had no idea about. I mean, not like a topic that I knew anything about. And then we really got into The Misfits, the John Huston movie, which she's obsessed with. When I dialed in on Zoom, she had this huge piece of art up for The Misfits right in the background. And yeah, it's always cool to listen to people talk about what they're passionate about, just like Jed.
Yeah, passion or obsession or just sort of hung up on something that I can't let go of. So yeah, good stuff.
I know. I always love it. You come up with such clever ideas for topics. Like, I follow what you're watching on Letterboxd, and also he posts a lot on Twitter, like thoughts as he's watching movies. He is one of the most voracious readers and cinephiles that I know. And so if you're not following Jed Ayers, you have to do that. I'll link to it when I post this, how to do that. But we thought of this idea, I want to say like last fall, or I should say we, I can't take any credit for it. It was Jed who came up with it. I think it was either before or right after we did that Elmore Leonard Western episode. And I thought, such a good idea.
Yeah, well, I had been, the reason this came up is because I discovered two of these movies for myself right at that time. Like, these aren't, you know, The Third Man is certainly something I've, you know, been in love with for a long time. But a couple of these films were brand new to me. I watched them pretty much back to back about this time last year, I think. So, yeah, I just realized, oh, they're really a nice thematic little phase that that Carol Reed went through. So, yeah, they're very, very specifically connected to each other. And I we haven't said the name of the, I suppose people will know the name of the episode, though.
The War Noir. Carol Reed. Yeah.
Yeah. And not just Carol Reed, because you could do, you could do other types of podcasts about Carol Reed. And we're not just talking about Graham Greene. You could talk about other
That's
types
its own
of
thing.
Yeah. You know, we talked about possibly mentioning the Fallen Idol in this episode, but it just, you know, it didn't really go in with the theme of the others, but man, you could do a Graham Greene Frustrated Lovers podcast that is going to have Carol Reed stuff in it too. Yeah. So, but yeah, the war noir of Carol Reed, just, I liked the way it sounded. So.
Yeah. And I came up with Man of War Noir because all of these movies have the word man in the title. So
they do.
For those listening, the films we're going to talk about today are The Third Man, of course, Odd Man Out, The Man Between, and Our Man in Havana. I had actually only seen two of these. I had seen, of course, The Third Man, which is, you know, one of the greatest films of all time. And then I had also seen The Man Between, I think a few years ago. I don't know if I just stumbled it on TCM or Canopy, or if there was a Criterion Channel thing. I can't remember what, but I loved it when I caught it a few years ago. Odd Man Out, I can't remember if I saw, so I'm going to say I did not, because when I put it on, it was like completely new to me. So I don't know if I saw it a long time ago and forgot. And Our Man in Havana, I have wanted to see for the longest time. So I was glad you gave me the excuse, because I remember enjoying the hell out of the book.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we should, before we, maybe we should just dive right in and so and focus on one and move on from there. But
do you
Carol
have a place
Reed, you want to start?
Yeah, Carol Reed, of course, was a British filmmaker, and he started out as in the dialogue department, became an assistant director, and made some sort of realism, worker-centric style dramas in the early 30s, kind of like British real-world realism, and then kind of got into comedy and, you know, kind of moved with the times. Interestingly enough, Graham Greene was a film critic in the 30s who reviewed a lot of his movies, and you know, for even when he didn't love the film, he could see that something was going on with this director and putting his own stamp on it. And finally, he said something like, if he had the right material, he's going to go places, essentially. And so it's really cool that they wound up working together. This all started to change and shift in around World War II. Night Train to Munich was sort of a comedy thriller in sort of a Hitchcockian kind of mode that he made that did very well at the time. And then he, you know, started working. He loved working with really creative storytellers. He himself would take a script and work on it. And so I think it was natural that he would find Graham Greene and they would collaborate, and they were changed by the war. And you can see that in these films. So it was really cool to kind of sit down and watch these. He's a filmmaker who, when you look up Carol Reed, you might be like, oh, he won an Oscar for Oliver, and think that's what he did with his whole career. And you're like, no. And one of the things I love about this group of movies that you chose, Jed, was Americans really hadn't bought in too heavily to a lot of British films around this time. And they were saying, like, when we try to pander to them or whatever, they can see the phoniness. And so they said, we need to make our own stories our own way and just be authentic. And then, you know, storytelling will work universally. And it did. So maybe he was also, we're going to talk about some actors who were in those kitchen sink dramas in the 50s. And so maybe he was a forefather of this. He's kind of the noir war. He's kind of at the crux there. He's right there. Yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned the war really did change his career path as is true for, you know, many filmmakers on all sides of that conflict. But you know, was kind of rushed into making the propaganda films for you know, the national identity stuff. And then I think with Third Man, it was so distinct. I mean, Night Train to Munich is kind of halfway between. It is a war effort movie, but it's you know, it's a lot more plot driven than you know, say the way forward or you know, what some of those other just Isn't It Great to Be a Brit in the Army, The Way Ahead, The True Glory, things like that. But Night Train to Munich was, you know, was a great thriller. But it was also, it was very much concerned with you know, the mission. Great about these, you know, I think there's a lot of espionage thrillers and things like that are tangential to this, but I think that this subject, the war noir, is distinct in that it's not a national
It's not a flag
concern.
No.
Well, and I mean, the story isn't even, you know, it's people caught between loyalties and also people just kind of cynical, a lot of cynical protagonists in these or characters that the protagonists are obsessed with or you know, who are war profiteers or black marketers, things like that. So, you know, like the Third Man is post-war, but it's very much about the consequences and the fallout of World War II. And we find the naive American Joseph Cotton, Holly Martins coming into Vienna, which is controlled, you know, four different sections of the city, controlled by the different governments. And you know, he goes there to meet his friend, Harry Lime, who has just died, he finds as he gets there. And for people who haven't seen the film, you probably only know that Orson Welles is in it, and he plays Harry Lime, the guy who's dead at the beginning of the movie. So he's not dead.
Yeah,
in fact.
Exactly. We can't really, don't get mad at us on spoilers for this, because it's the Third Man, you guys. Like, you know what you're listening to. Yes. And Orson Welles, of course, famously called it like the ultimate star part, because they talk about you for most of the movie and then you appear. And he has the most famous introduction, you know, with the shadows. This is a film, it's so stylized, all the Dutch angles and the German expressionist cinematography by Robert Krasker. Of course, the zither music, which was not like intended going in. It was a discovery that Carol Reed made when he was there. He heard Anton Karas playing the zither. And, you know, why use those Viennese waltzes that you're expecting? Why not use this? Which was weird. Initially, people were like, what's with the music? But then the more you listen and watch the film, it just seems perfect for it. And you can't really picture anything else. Joseph Cotten is so good in this. It was supposed to be Noel Coward, actually. Selznick was pushing for Coward instead of Orson Welles. And luckily, you know, Carol Reed stuck to his guns and got Orson Welles because you need him. At one time, Orson Welles said he like wrote the whole thing, or, you know, he took credit for everything. And then later he kind of had to play that down, like, oh, no, it was Carol Reed's baby, him and Graham Greene. But he did write one of the most famous little monologues there about the cuckoo clock, even though that itself, they said, was probably taken from a few other sources. And you can find that older movies, just like little bits here and there, might have inspired it, might have been subconscious. But, you know, the way he delivers this is perfect. It's kind of one of those things about your old friends, and then you find out how people change, and because of circumstance and because of what they did. And once you start to look the other way and go along with something, you know, go into the gray area, where do you draw the line? Yeah.
Yeah. I love the, you know, that's what I'm drawn to about crime fiction is, you know, what, and Westerns, you know, places where law and morality are starkly in contrast often, or at least very pliable, you know, and the themes of I like
the gray area.
The gray areas, the and not even just the gray areas. I mean, Harry Lime is really a villain.
Yes.
He's not a gray, it's really not a gray area. The gray part is
might have been affection, the beginning. Yes.
Well, the affection that that his friends and the woman who you know, loves him have for him. What do you do with that? Do you
what someone is? Yeah.
Yeah. What do you owe people you love? And what do you you know, owe your country or the law? You know, Trevor Howard doesn't get mentioned often in it, but I think he brings
brings
a lot of weight to and a lot of brevity or levity rather to his role as the captain or major Calloway as Joseph Cotten, the American is always butchering his name, Callahan. He has to be corrected constantly. I'm not Irish. I'm English.
He's
Callaway.
Doing that old insult of like making him an Irishman because English wouldn't like that, that kind of thing. Mm. So it's a little ding.
Well, okay. I mean, that's an interesting thing. Occurred to me. I just thought it was a,
It was
an ugly American thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of, kind of, playful, not really really mean, but there's a lot of digs at Americanism, and Americanism throughout, especially Graham Greene's
work,
books and films. But that apparently the American cut of theatrical cut of The Third Man had a lot of anti-American lines and things like that taken out. So I haven't seen, I don't know if it exists anywhere with the American theatrical cut.
Yeah, Selznick's cut. Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It'd be interesting to see those next to each other and how much that changes.
Yeah, it's a fascinating movie because of all of the national identities and these perceived insults, like the Irish one would be called an English name and vice versa. And then we have a character who has like forged papers And, you know, can we not include her in the Russians? You know, she's Czech. And like, you know, it has a lot to do with where you are in the world and how you see things. And yeah, Graham Greene was no stranger to his digs at Americans and the USA, for sure. And I love that you did bring up Trevor Howard, because that's a fascinating role. I think I like at right at the beginning, he's like completely honest about his friend. You know, this is somebody who did this on the black market, diluted penicillin. So many people died. Like, it's a horrible, horrible thing.
The lucky ones died.
Yeah, the lucky ones. The other ones are suffering. And, you know, he feels this sense of loyalty to your friend. Like, you know, don't talk about my friend that way. Kind of that old thing. Like, he might be an asshole, but he's my asshole. But also he's like, could he really, you know, he doesn't want to have the disillusionment about who his friend is. And he goes on a hell of a moral and ethical journey learning that. Yeah.
Yeah. And he still feels conflicted by his, you know, ultimate betrayal of his friend, you know, even as he's learned what a villain, what a callous, completely callous villain his friend became. And but it still tears him up to betray him, and he has to find a way to justify that. And you know, he picks a woman whose cause he's going to take up and champion, and that'll be enough for him to betray his friend. But she doesn't want it. You know, she wouldn't accept that price. She doesn't want to betray Harry. She wouldn't take that over her own interests. So yeah, it's a really great, I love that everybody's pretty miserable at the end of the film.
Oh, the ending's perfect. Yeah. Of course, Selznick wanted them to, you know, reunite at the end. He falls for this woman who was Harry's girlfriend, who's still deeply in love with him. Even after she finds out she doesn't want to betray him, she doesn't want to, you know, lead to his death or get him in trouble. So he like picks this sort of, I mean, you know, sometimes we don't really pick who you fall in love with, but she picks a really hopeless, or he does, idea of I'm going to put her on a pedestal, or I'm going to do this, and almost take Harry's place. And no, but yeah, it's one of those perfect movies. Walker Percy wrote about it in The Moviegoer, and that was actually quoted in Roger Ebert's review about how this was the film that really hooked him and got him into film. Mm. So if you haven't read that, I'm sure it's online. It's also in one of his great movies books, people who are listening. So yeah, check out Ebert on The Third Man for sure.
I feel I would be amiss if I didn't bring up just a really Philistine view of mine, which is that I've mentioned it to you before, and we've had fun, you know, going back and forth on it, but I was not a fan of the Zither music.
I know, and you and weren't.
I should say that I liked the music. I just didn't like it in the movie. And
has it grown on you at all, or you're still
it
not?
Has it? Well, I should say this. My feelings have complicated. They've complicated. You know,
Joseph Cotton. You're figuring it out. Yeah,
I'm the dumb American, you know, sentimental guy who's finding out that Santa Claus isn't real and things like that. But I'm complicated on it. I have to give it to Carol Reed, I think, in the end, because he did stick by so many on so many fronts. You know, he and Graham Greene had disagreements about the ending.
Graham Greene and Selznick had
disagreements about the casting, there were lots of key decisions that Carol Reed stuck to his gut and his guns on, and yeah. and the zither was one of those. I guess I always felt like it was kind of undercutting the.
Okay, you didn't like the counterpoint part of it.
I didn't. I really felt like it was undercutting, but I'm complicated.
You're complicated.
I don't. Yeah. I'm not anti zither music, but
you find the unorthodox quality of it here kind of sticks out to you.
Yeah, I have to admit that it probably there's ways in which maybe it would be too smooth without it. Maybe
if they did go with the Viennese waltzes or that kind of thing,
or just you know, like I think I've watched lately a lot of really like low budget crime movies with these terrible cheap scores that are just kind of exactly what you'd expect, you know, or they're like TV show scores, you know, just mm-hmm. kind of filler
dun, dun, dun.
Stuff that's yeah. just it's just uninspired and mm-hmm. You know, if the zither at least makes me think, it kind of pokes me a little and doesn't let me get too comfortable, and I'm not sure what I should be feeling in this scene with these really dark realities and this really jaunty music. So I have to give it to Carol Reed for making a distinct choice. Yeah. But I also have to be honest that I'm not always I'm not always in lockstep with him. You know, I'm he's keeping me engaged that way, I guess. You know, if I had my own cut of the third man, it would probably be different and probably worse. So I'm I got to give it to him, but I do have to say sometimes I want it a little more conventional in there, and I like to watch silent movies with the sound down, you know.
Yeah.
and replace the old scores with often with movie scores that I already like, and I it would probably be a mistake for me to do something like that with Third Man, because there isn't really anything else like it, to you know take away from the distinction of the film would probably make it lesser.
Yeah, I guess I love it, but it is kind of interesting. It's like when I saw like Argento and some of those mm-hmm. scores were so unexpected, and at first you're like, what the hell is going on? But then you really get into it. So I kind of like it when there is this wild amount of creativity. I think sometimes it can be just noise. So many scores nowadays just feel like, I don't know, blah or wall to wall. Yeah, like what you're not going to remember that score, essentially. It's not the score from The Last of the Mohicans or, you know, something you're going to be completely taking with you. But this era for Carol Reed, Graham Greene, I have to say to those listening that if you haven't seen The Fallen Idol, it's kind of harder to find, but it is one of my favorites. I almost think it's maybe just a hair or two less perfect than The Third Man in my view, but I adore that film. I'm obsessed with it. It's one of my faves for sure. And it's interesting, when Graham Greene wrote The Third Man, it was just like a treatment for a screenplay. It was never meant to be a book that was published. And they put that with the story for the Fallen Idol and kind of packaged those two together because they weren't supposed to stand on their own as their own thing. So I find that interesting, because those are definitely my two favorites. Odd Man Out is a film that I read Sam Peckinpah and Roman Polanski both say is maybe their favorite film. Polanski says it is his favorite film, and that it's the type of film that he wanted to make. He said, I'm always looking for that kind of stuff. And once you watch it, you start looking at it and thinking about Frantic in a certain way, or some of the other films that he has done. So that's interesting. Odd Man Out is a fascinating one. We have James Mason. And James Mason is playing an IRA guy who broke out of prison like 6 months earlier. So he's been staying with this woman who's in love with him and her grandmother or her mother. I can't remember which. And they're going to stage this robbery. And the people in the IRA crew are wondering, should he do it? Because he's not like maybe physically up to it, but he stands firm that he wants to go along. But then there's all this stuff that's like bad luck that you start thinking of, like, oh, you're bringing a gun. We don't normally bring gun, that kind of thing. Of course, stuff goes wrong. Somebody gets shot and James Mason accidentally is the trigger man. And then he's hiding for the rest of the film. So it's another film in shadows. I like the idea of this film and I like the performances better than the movie itself, at least this first time. I might need to watch it again. I feel like sometimes we spent some time with characters I'm not really interested in. I think it's very much like character driven in places in a way that's surprising. I wanted to get back to the, you know, man on the run idea, but overall it's a super stylish movie, gorgeous to look at, really, really good performance by James Mason.
It's a really haunting film. And it is one that I saw, I'm not sure when I saw it. It's, you know, sometime this century. You know, probably 15 years ago or so would have seen it for the first time. And I don't know that I would have connected it with The Third Man. I'm not sure I would have understood, who Carol Reed was at the time, but it really kind of blew me away when I first saw it. And I've enjoyed, especially as you tack the other two films onto this list, I've enjoyed rewatching it and seeing the similarities between the films and the ways that they're distinct. And I mentioned that to kind of, if we're going to coin war noir as a subgenre, then, you know, this on the surface would seem to break the rules in that this one is, you know, the James Mason character is completely obsessed with the cause. You know, it is a nationalistic goal that he has, where I think this does qualify for, you know, our episode, the war noir, you know, the troubles, the struggle for Irish independence.
For sure.
Is that I think he's the main character, but he's also really, he's the MacGuffin of the film.
Yeah.
He is, you know, that mission that he has for the organization, everything is for the organization. This mission that he's on to, you know, rob a mill to fund their struggle for independence. That's what he's concerned with, but nobody else in the film is concerned. I mean, minor characters are concerned with that, but the film is really about the way he affects everyone others in the community.
Yeah.
His single-minded, you know, his goals. Some people are very supportive of him and his mission. Some people are very against it. Some people feel angry that they are paying, you know, for his actions in, you know, their lives. But it's a film of vignettes of him, this wounded man on the run in a you know, in an occupied territory where everyone, you know, every person's path that he crosses, he is putting them in danger
for sure
from, you know, the occupying force. And it's really, you know, the legend at the beginning of the film that, you know, this isn't a political statement movie. This is about, I forget the exact wording on it, but, you know, it's about the people and their individual reactions or, you know, their hearts. And so everyone he comes in contact with, he just completely lays them bare.
Yep.
As far as what their what motivates them, what they are loyal to, mm-hmm. you know, they're either shown to be very courageous or cowardly, very self-interested or very generous and compassionate. You know, it's almost a Jesus movie. This is almost like Pasolini's Theorem or something like that. You know,
where it ends with Christ-like poses. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's very much, even though he is obsessed with, you know, his nationalistic goals, mm-hmm. The point of the film really isn't, you know, that's kind of the MacGuffin. That's kind of the frame that what the movie's about is used to bring out. It is absolutely stylish. It is so amazing. Mm-hmm. All four of these films really are delicious to look at. The real locations, you know, this being Belfast, Third Man's Vienna, Havana for Our Man in Havana, and Berlin for The Man Between, you know, these real locations have so much personality. And they're shot so sumptuously. You talked about the canted angles and things like that that Reed employs in all of these films. There's an energy to them and a lushness that's just hypnotic. And, you know, like yesterday or this morning, I work nights, so everything is topsy-turvy for me. I'm not sure where I'm at. But I, in the last 24 hours, I watched all four films, you know, back to back to back to back. And, you know, I was just swooning really with the style yeah. of these things. I love that that Odd Man Out is a, you know, it's about a 8 or 12 hour time
yep.
time period, yes. you know, it mm-hmm. and it's very compressed, but it also goes from. It's bright and sunny at the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
It turns
night.
Dark.
Yep.
It starts raining. It becomes snow. You know, by the end of the film, there's a blanket of snow over the whole city. So even though it's a very compressed time frame, it feels like you've seen a lot change. You know, it's wonderful. And of course, as Mason's character. Is yeah, I mean it's noir. He's doomed, but as it becomes clear that he's not going to survive, as he's just spending this film slowly dying and mm-hmm. having you know hallucinations and things like that. The performance gets kind of both more still. And reserved in the body as he's conserving his energy and he's wounded and moving slowly and awkwardly, but his eyes are so expressive and you know there's one character he finds near the end of the film is an artist who's been looking for you know the right expression to hang in this painting that he's working on, and he goes out to find, you know, the whole town, the whole city is looking for the guy who held up the mill and is, you know, somewhere in the city. Some people want the reward. Some people want to get him to safety.
He wants those eyes. Yeah.
He wants to find him so he can paint his face. You know, he's like his thoughts, I forget the line, something like he's having the most wonderful thoughts. Look at those eyes. And, you know, that's a wild, fun character.
It is. And I like so much of what you were saying, Jed. I should point out for people listening who maybe don't know, this actually came first. This was 1947. So the third man was a couple years later. And you can kind of see him sort of experimenting visually with some of the things that he was going to pull off there. Something I forgot to say about the third man is director William Wyler, who was a friend, kind of made a joke and sent him like the equivalent of a level and said, like, next time put this on top of the camera with all those Dutch angles. Yeah, he wasn't really enjoying that. So I think, you know, but one thing, just like with the zither, he had these ideas of telling a story visually, everything you were just saying about the weather changing. And all of these films are in black and white. But like Jed pointed out, you know, you start with sun and then it goes through changes. So they are reflective of what the character is going through. Sometimes it's a little heavy handed in that way, in that regard. But it works, just like in the third man, stuff happening way up high. When these declarations are going on about like the cuckoo clock and finding things out, and then the depths of, you know, the sewers. And so everything is there for a reason visually and, you know, thematically. You can tell he's a very literary filmmaker. This is a fascinating one. I think James Mason is such an interesting choice because most people today just think of him as like the Lolita guy, essentially. But if you see these earlier films like Five Fingers is a really great one that not enough people talk about, or this, can really see, you know, who this man was as an actor. And when I looked it up, there was an article on the TCM website that was very fascinating about this, saying that James Mason at the time really felt there were only a handful of worthwhile directors in England to work for, essentially, and loved that Reed was famous for giving actors really free rein to discover characters. And one of his co-stars, Dan O'Herlihy, noted that James was almost too intellectual for his own good, but he had much more depth than most. Although he wasn't very emotional, he could indicate emotion on screen superbly. There was an austere vulnerability about him, which could be immensely powerful. And I think you see that in this movie for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, he's, he, you know, I think I know him most, or at least got to know him earliest as, you know, the kind of sadistic villain, you know, with the posh accent and things like that in a lot of stuff. But yeah, he, there's a whole different energy to him in that, that for me anyway, I found was very disarming. I was like, I don't know this guy at all. I thought, you know, he was, again, I was maybe my perception was unfortunately skewed by some of that latter era stuff where he's kind of playing similar roles over and over. But he's great in this. To get back to the comment about the you know, sending the level, Wyler sending the level to think. I'm trying to, have you seen any of these films on a big screen?
No, I would love to. No.
I can't imagine how
disorienting
how that would, what that would have done on a big screen, what that would have felt like to do these. I will say all four films, Our Man in Havana, the least of, but still it's in there. But all four films do make such a case for pick an interesting shot, an interesting landscape, and just move your character through them. Yep. And that's going to be so rich. For, you know, I mean, Westerns were doing it, you know, a lot of the best Westerns or, you know, most enduring are the ones where the director understands.
understands and this. Scope. Yes.
Yeah. And just have your characters move through them. They don't have to speak, you know,
it doesn't have to be too static. Yeah.
Odd Man Out, the third man and the man between, especially, spend, you know, they get the setup out of the way, and then the last third of the film or quarter of the film is often just moving through these incredible spaces, you know, these real locations. There's a handful of sets in there, and I like in Odd Man Out, especially, there are, you'll go from real locations to sets, and the sets kind of heighten the surreality of his interior, you know, what's going on with him.
For sure.
You know, you kind of start off in this gritty real location, and then suddenly he's moved into this snow covered stage with, you know, a fake houses and with lights on and things like that in the background. And it's, you know, at his most delirious and things like that. And it really does heighten everything. But the attention to detail in the frames, making them just gorgeous and deep. The photography is so beautiful and that way. But all he's got to do, he doesn't have a lot of lines.
No.
Does not have many lines in the film. We understand what the conflict is, and he's just gotta move. Just walk through these amazing sets and these amazing frames, and all four films have a section like that, though Our Man in Havana's is the smallest and maybe least notable, but tip to filmmakers out there, just spend a lot of time
planning building, out your shots. Yes.
Building and work with production design. Shot.
Yeah.
And just have people walk through it, you know, just drive through it. Move through interesting spaces it became clear, especially watching these films. That's so much of what I go to movies for, is to, you know, whether they're Westerns or science fiction epics, you know, I mean, my favorite things about Blade Runner, the first time I saw it, were just him walking through the streets, you know, those very interesting streets and things like that. That's so I don't know if that makes it cheaper or more interesting and rich.
I think it does.
That's such a trick.
Provided it goes with the plot, exactly what you're saying, Jed. It's like it makes it so much more interesting. If there isn't a lot there, then it's like, oh, we're just looking at eye candy. And there were a couple Oscar baity pictures that I'm not going to name those movies that are, you know, falling back on the beauty of the sets and the costumes. And these are not great films, for example. But you know, if it works, if it's a good marriage of material and theme and somebody who knows what they're doing, then listen to Jed, you guys. That's kind of the lesson here. But I know that Reed was never completely satisfied. In that same Turner Classic Movies article, it talked about he watched the movie once with the screenwriter Ben Hecht, of course, famous screenwriter, and he offered the projectionist £100 to cut out 30 seconds that were just bothering him. He's like, 30 seconds too long, needs to go, just to cut it out. And the projectionist's like, no, he refused, thank goodness. So I don't know which 30 seconds, but it's funny. I guess everyone is going to find problems in their own work. Yeah. Yeah.
And then,
Man Between is the film you talked about. Now, when it came to The Man Between, that is one that has these great wide open spaces. And we have James Mason again. The deal with that movie was the budget kept getting smaller and smaller, and the script wasn't good, and he was in a rush and he was kind of hurried. And but for what it is, I actually think it's a hell of a good movie. It's super entertaining. The cast is great. You have Claire Bloom, again, James Mason. There's a lot to this one. It's just kind of the ambiance of espionage. And some people didn't like the cutesy factor of like a little boy on a bike kind of going between the East and West Berlin, and like, how is the kid getting across? And I know there were a lot of criticisms on that level, but just go with it. The film where a British young woman, Claire Bloom, arrives and she is greeted by the wife of her brother, who is German, and she seems to be hiding something. She's nervous. And we find out that she has sort of a relationship with James Mason. We're not sure of his allegiances and his story. And yeah, this movie I had seen, like I said, a few years ago. It's on Canopy right now, if you're listening. I don't know how much longer it'll be there, but you can find it there. It's worth a watch. And I know you were enjoying the hell out of it too, Jed.
I was. So this is one of the ones that I saw for the first time probably about a year ago.
Okay.
And it absolutely blew me away. I mean, watching it several times in the last month or so, it really does remind you a lot thematically of The Third Man.
For
sure. You could definitely be forgiven for thinking of it, especially when it first came out, as, oh, he's going back to, he's really desperate to get back that third man success or something. There's a lot of similarity. James Mason plays, essentially a Harry Lime type character.
Yeah.
He's between the two sides of Berlin. It's post-war. It's divided into East and West, but the wall is not up yet. The Berlin Wall has not been constructed yet. But there's a lot of back and forth between the two sides. We understand that there are agents on both sides, Western and Eastern agents, who kidnap people, grab them off the street, mm-hmm. or smuggle them, both ways across the lines. And he is someone who dabbles in that, and his motivations and exactly what's going on with him become clear later. It's perhaps difficult to follow on a first
a little bit watch. Yeah, I agree with you.
But the first time I saw it, I think I was just sort of delighted that it kept turning my expectations on my head. That at first it seems like it's going to be about the Claire Bloom character finding out that her sister-in-law is having an affair. Mm-hmm. She's very perceptive. Her brother, the American military officer, is oblivious that his wife's got a secret life, but it's immediately obvious to
everyone.
Mm-hmm. Character, there's something going on with her. She's hiding mm-hmm. something. And what is it? And
I love that actress too. Yes.
Claire Bloom or Hildegard Knef?
Oh, I love Claire Bloom, of course, but I loved Hildegard for this. My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Such a great, great face. I'm trying to think who she reminded me of. But she reminded me of another actress.
What?
Maybe it was Anna Gunn or something from
a little bit of Anna Gunn or Kim Novak in Vertigo. Kind of looks a little bit.
The hairdo and all that.
Yeah.
And that's another part, is she's got that hair. She's got a new hairdo that her sister-in-law recognizes immediately. She's like, you have a new hairdo and it looks great. And she's like, thanks. Your brother hasn't, I've had it for weeks and he hasn't noticed yet. So, he's totally checked out. But these women, I'm trying to think what it was. It was you who said it, and I'm trying to think what movie. Oh, it was Zodiac. It was your episode, one of your episodes on Blake's Zodiac Chronicles, where you were talking about the women in the film being so tuned into the danger that the guys are really oblivious to, and it's.
Yeah, like when Chloe
or it's arrogance or it's something, but you're like, women understand danger and they're very tuned to it. And so,
I know what you're talking about with Zodiac. It was the scene where he goes on the date with Chloe and he's like, I'm kind of worried about my friend. He's meeting that. And she's like, isn't that dangerous? Shouldn't we call, like, you know, should he go alone? Like what is going on? And they hadn't really put together how dangerous it was. Yeah.
Well, I think about your insight there often in films. And I think this is a great one where, she is immediately, she understands there's something going on here and I'm not sure how I should feel about it. And my brother, who this will very greatly concern, is completely oblivious to it.
Yep.
And she doesn't know whether or not to like wake him up and tell him, hey, there's something going on or not. But the James Mason character is he's a man between two worlds. He's a man between two loyalties. You know, is he the villain, the same kind of villain ultimately that Harry Lime is, or, you know, is there something more complex to him? Has he done anything as awful as what Harry Lime did? There's a great line that he's got later in the film where he talks about, you know, he used to be he studied to be a lawyer. He believed in the law and justice and all the, you know, these institutions of justice. And then the war came along and completely obliterated all of his ideals and all of, you know, he's, you know, I was absolutely, nothing had prepared me for what, you know, what there that was. And I can't go back to being that way anymore. But I think of the four films, I found The Man Between to be the one that I just wanted to keep watching over and over again.
Yeah.
And they have, all the films are visually amazing, perhaps because I'd seen The Third Man several times before. Mm-hmm. I was less struck by the visuals, even though the visuals are amazing.
Oh yeah.
I kept thinking The Man Between might be, have the best move your characters through interesting spaces.
I agree with you there, especially because of the budget constraints and also the idea of East and West Berlin. And I love that we're in sync here, Jed, because I mean, The Third Man's a perfect film, you know, 5 stars.
Yeah.
But as I was like ranking them to kind of remember, and I kind of struggle with giving movies rankings on Letterboxd anyway, Man Between is the one I gave 4. I was like, you know what, this is, I just want to keep watching. It's a great kind of a spy thriller, but also there's some intrigue. You have women trying to figure stuff out. I love that kind of a novice sleuth idea, which I'll always be drawn to, a woman who just puts stuff together and decides she's gonna, you know, well, I'm gonna help. And, you know, doesn't have any experience with the government or war and just goes for it. Yeah.
The it's full of odd details too, that are probably, that were, I don't know, maybe they were just a thing that has been lost to time. Have you ever seen, there's a scene in The Man Between where Mason and Bloom are out at a restaurant.
Oh, with the phone?
And the phone is, there's a phone at their table that's just ringing and ringing and ringing. I've never seen that before. Have you seen that before?
Yes, I've seen it in a few movies.
Explain it to me.
Cabaret, it's in that movie. But I've also been at a restaurant once that was still doing stuff like that.
No, really?
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Where, if it was, I don't remember where it was, but I had relatives tell me about these kind of things where you could go And if you liked somebody at table 27, you could just call. And so it was kind of a good way to sort of meet people. You know, you didn't have to actually walk across the room and do the scary thing. Like, can I buy you a drink? You could call like, yeah. And so that's what's going on. Anyone who's seen Cabaret knows what I'm talking about. But that's what's happening in this movie, too. Yeah.
It was a delightful, very puzzling thing for me. I don't think I've seen Cabaret and I don't remember that, but the way Mason's character explains it, as the phone is just incessantly ringing at their, at their table and no one's picking it up. He says, oh yes. You can, if you see someone and they annoy you, you can call them and tell them, you know, that's a charming way to describe this to me very odd social.
It's like early internet, Jed.
Never, right.
Way well, to be a reply guy. Yeah.
Well, it really took me by surprise. It was a delightful little detail, though, that I was like, certainly they didn't just make this up for this film. This must have been a thing. Like, but you know, was it a European thing? Was it also in the U.S.? When did this stop being a thing? It was it the use of it really what he said? You could just, just call somebody up and from across the room, they don't know who's talking to them, and you just, you know, shit talk them or you know, breathe heavy or whatever. I don't know. But that was a nice little thing that I'd never seen before or hadn't remember seeing. So the man between brought to me.
I know people don't even use their phones the way that we used to in our generation.
Right.
Like if you liked someone, you actually had to call them on the phone and talk. I mean, that's a novel thing. You didn't have to type. Our buddy Sean was telling his nephew could not get over it. Like, wait a minute, there was a book with everyone's phone number and you just had that? And it's like, yeah, if you knew the parents' name of the girl or the boy that you liked, you know, you had their number. Like, you didn't have to go ask and be really scared. I mean, right. It was really terrifying to actually dial the number of the person you had a crush on and talk. But yeah.
You know, it never occurred to me. Shit, I'm just thinking to get a phone book and look up. There was a girl in high school that I asked for her phone number and she gave it to me. And when I went to call her, I realized she'd only written down six numbers.
And, oh, no.
And
you should have checked.
I never figured out if that was intentional.
She might have been just nervous. Yeah,
she might have been, but I dialed so many different variations on those six digits. It never occurred to me to check a phone book. So
okay, so traumatic.
Don't ask me for advice on how to do things ever.
I know. Yeah, me neither. Exactly. Kids today, I don't understand. Yes. Yes, but The Man Between, great film for sure. Our Man in Havana was one that I remember reading the book. I read a lot of Graham Greene, but this was, you know, kind of funnier Graham Greene. Mm-hmm. I think this one is a blast. I know that there were some issues with censorship, and he thought he was going to be able to get around it because Graham Greene was tight with Cuba and like, oh, you know. And but Cuba had some things to say and the producers had some things to say, but it's a fun one. It's a spy movie of a different stripe, let's say. Yeah. I'll let you take it away on this, Jed.
Yeah. So it is a comedy.
Yeah.
But it's a comedy about very serious things.
Yeah.
Very devastating things, and there is a really dark turn mm-hmm. near the end of the film that I think qualifies it for inclusion in this war noir category. It mm-hmm. is about a man who is an Englishman living in Havana pre-revolution Havana, but but really right on the cusp. There's revolution in the air, even though it has not come to fruition yet. Green wrote it. He started writing it. I think within days or weeks of Castro landing to invade, the book was published.
It was originally going to be about World War II because he remembered at the end of the war, guys like making phony reports up to keep getting paid. But then it was like kind of a British looking down on, ooh, I don't think we should have it about world. So then he changed it to Cuba. And well, I also think it was first going to be set in Estonia. There were a few things that was going to be about a guy needing money for his lavish wife, and that wasn't great. So he changed it to daughter. And yeah, exactly what you're saying, you know, Kismet.
He starts writing it. As Castro's Batista regime falls, and the movie starts production about 6 weeks, maybe 10 weeks after the fall of Batista's regime. And so, revolution is in the air, though it has not happened yet. So it's a British man living in Havana under the end of the Batista era. So Batista is never named in the film.
No, not
it's
at
a
all.
Very it's a very kind of
generic-y
oppressive police state. The police are enemies of everybody. They watch out for the police. They're going to kidnap you and torture you. And and the way that it's so blithely tossed off, there's a character, the chief of police, the captain, he's got a nickname, and it's just kind of tossed off like, oh, it's a cute nickname because he tortures tortures people. And which kind of underscores how horrific these sorts of situations are, that there's such an accepted part of reality that that you have a cutesy nickname for the torturing guy. But he's a British man. Alec Guinness plays the main character, is a British man who's just a businessman. He's a vacuum cleaner salesman for a major brand of vacuum cleaner in Havana, who's recruited kind of against his will, kind of passively by MI5. MI5 is the one that's outside England, and MI6 is inside England. Is that right? It's like the FBI, CIA thing. The one's domestic and one's international. But I think it's MI5 is outside England. He's recruited by them to be our man in Havana, just supply intelligence about what's going on there. And he has no interest in doing it. He has
those vacuums, just
he's a single dad. His wife has left him. He's got a teenage daughter who is a handful. She's extremely religious and he's not. She's also extremely desired by men of all ages.
She wants a horse.
She's very he would say probably kind of corrupted by Americanism, seeping into the country. And he is too. He loves the decadent.
Ooh, he loves money, gambling.
The gambling, the red light
girls.
District. which Green did too. Green loved.
Oh God,
red light districts all over the world. That was where he wanted to go visit, and I read a book about him and this novel and this film that was full of tales of him checking out brothels and pornographic movie houses and things like that, that were just kind of what really stimulated him. But
yeah, and the man decides that in order just to keep getting money, he's just going to make things up of observations he makes of people that he sees. And so he pretends that he's recruiting and turning all of these agents. In one of the funniest sequences, he like draws plans for a weapon, but it's like based on a vacuum cleaner. And like when it gets sent over, they're even like, does this look like a vacuum cleaner to you? And oh my goodness. Yeah, it is really funny. But then it becomes serious because they're like, holy shit, we have these plans for this weapon. And so we need to send him support. He's doing such a good job. And so they send him a secretary. It was going to be Lauren Bacall, but then it wasn't. It's Maureen O'Hara. And so she's there. And then they send additional support staff. And then it becomes harder to deny that, like, you know, this is happening. But one of his quote unquote operatives, who's not really an operative, is killed, and then there's danger and things arise. Jean Seberg was going to play the daughter at one point, but she chose this other movie that, you know, went nowhere called Breathless by Jean-Luc Godard. And anyway, she chose right in that respect. This is a fun movie, but of course Breathless is Breathless. Maureen O'Hara talked about making this movie and staying at the hotel and meeting Guevara at the time as kind of like this up-and-coming freedom fighter, and how he would regale, and he was trying to charm her by saying how much he knew of Irish history and their oppression and their fighting, and how his cap that he wore was actually an Irish one. And so she said, like, he was laying into the Irish heritage very well. Maureen O'Hara is great. It's really funny. You know, when he has to kind of keep up the front of all of these people, these operatives, and she's trying to see, she's dubious, but then she's not, and then she figures it out. I mean, she's, you know, no nonsense. So it's great. It's again, like Man Between, we have a woman who knows, she can see through stuff some of the guys couldn't see through. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a movie that I sought out. I think I saw The Man Between, and it really blew me away. And I immediately said, okay, I've got to just seek out Carol Reed stuff, you know, because Third Man, Odd Man Out, and The Man Between just were such amazing films. I was like, I've got to find what else I'm missing here. And knowing Our Man in Havana as a Graham Greene title, I've jumped on it when it popped up streaming, and, you know, immediately I was like, okay, well, this is different than the other films. The tone is comedic. Alec Guinness is hilarious in this film. So funny. He's reminding me of like almost Peter Sellers-ish.
And I know he and Reed like butted heads, because he said something to Guinness, like, none of your, you know, method acting or your acting, just like act or don't get into it. And according to Guinness, so they butted heads, but whatever deal that was, I mean, Guinness was great. Coward is in it. Noel Coward, kind of as a, you know, I'm sorry I didn't give you the third man, but he's great. I love these guys. Yes, like you were saying, Peter Sellersy.
Yeah, and he's hilarious. And I was, you know, okay, this is not what those other films are, but I'm on board with what this is. And then it really did kind of sucker punch me at the end. It turned very dark and very, you know,
sardonic. Yeah.
It really disarmed me. And, you know, I loved it. I really loved the film. Watching all four of them multiple times, it's forgivable for someone to think this is kind of the lesser of the four, but it's it's wonderful. I love Graham Greene too. I really enjoyed finding out about his history in MI5 and the personal experiences that, you know, he drew on to make the story. Obviously, Jean Le Carre's Tailor of Panama, I was familiar with first.
Le Carre loved Green. Clearly, yeah.
Yeah, very clearly inspired by Our Man in Havana. But it's a great one. If you haven't seen it, it's on Tubi right now. So you can watch it for free or rent it at several different places. But I was surprised to find that it hadn't been very well received, because I really think it's a very, very good movie. It does have some of those canted angles. It's got a lot of really fun location shooting on the streets.
We're in Cuba. Mm-hmm.
Really great stuff. At the end of the film, not only is it thematically darker, but there's a really beautifully shot night sequence on the streets and different mm-hmm. nightclubs, brothels, and where dark things take place. But it's a fantastic film too. I think it deserves to be included in this company.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm glad that we could revisit all of these movies. Other ones that we would recommend, I have to say, of course, The Fallen Idol is one of my favorites. Do you have any others? I know Jed, being Jed, probably watched a bunch of extra movies.
I think Steven Soderbergh's The Good German is a
kind of ties into this. I didn't know about other Reed movies, but The Good German, Tailor of Panama, like these are great pulls. Yes.
Taylor of Panama. I mean, Casablanca is, you know, sort of
in that vein. Yeah.
Close to it. And Sirocco. I think Reed was probably influenced by Port of Shadows and Pepe Le Moque. I don't know how to pronounce these French words, these 1930s films starring Jean Gabin. Stylized, you know, real location shooting. What's the term? Is it French poetic realism, something like that, where it was a term I came across reading that I'd never heard before in the last few weeks. But, you know, I do think that these and several Le Carre adaptations, Claire Denis' film from 2022, Stars at Noon, the Dennis Johnson adaptation, I think that is if you like these films and you like the genre of the sort of the war noir, I think Stars at Noon is a great one to check out. Specifically, film to film comparisons. I think if you liked Odd Man Out, you know, you might try a movie from a couple of years ago called 71. Did you see that one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very almost, good.
I could see that almost like being not a remake, but kind of. Yeah.
One's about a British soldier, a kid who gets stuck behind in
Ireland.
I think it's Belfast. I'm trying. And you know, he has got to make his way out, out to safety. And you know, again, he kind of, as he is, encounters various people there. You know, has the same kind of effect on them. Some of them want to kill him. Some of them want to turn him in for a reward. Other people are very compassionate toward him. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting one. I think also John Ford's The Informer, which is about an IRA turncoat, a man who sells out his friends for money. And the remake of that, Jules Dassin's Uptight, those are interesting ones to watch with Odd Man Out.
Great recommendations. Yes.
We for The Man Between, if you liked that one, there's one called The Murderers Are Among Us, from a German filmmaker.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm not going to. But The Murderers Are Among Us. And that starred The Man Between's star, Hildegard Knef.
Yes.
That was a great post-war German film. Very haunted. Not quite a thriller. It's more of a melodrama. But it's got really great, stylish German expressionism photography and techniques that really, and especially in the climax, really pop. And I thought that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think more of the Graham Greene adaptations, check those out. Quiet American. Yeah, Quiet American. There's a bunch. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jed, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's always such a joy to talk about movies with you. You'll have to come up with another topic. Come on back for sure.
All right. Thanks for having me. I like the excuse to dig into a topic. So thanks, Jen.
Absolutely.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching.
This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.